This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk about environmental medicine. Environmental medicine concerns itself with all the things that, that are in our environment, things that support us, but also things that may harm us. And they're coming at us from many different directions in modern society. We're going to talk to the author of a book entitled Integrative Environmental Medicine. It's a book that's actually part of the Weill, that name sounds familiar, Dr. Andrew Weill, Integrative Medicine Library, and it is a wonderful compendium of information about all manner of environmental toxins, things that we can do to avoid exposure to some of these elements in our environment. And today we're going to talk to one of the co-editors of this book, which is actually a book that lined up some of the superstars in this field, people who are experts in various areas of environmental medicine. And Dr. Ailey Cohen is with us today. She has been a frequent guest here on Intelligent Medicine and is a physician in New Jersey. She is board certified in internal medicine, also in rheumatology, and she is an integrative rheumatologist. What a great idea, because there's so many integrative aspects to rheumatology besides administering powerful drugs to people with arthritis and lupus and all manner of these autoimmune ailments. She is also, I didn't know this, but looking at her bio, she has been voted a top doc in New Jersey for 2016. Congratulations, Dr. Cohen. That's a nice distinction. And you've really done yeoman service here in putting together some fantastic information. I think the best compendium I've ever seen on environmental medicine. So let's start out with a definition. What is environmental medicine? And the book is entitled Integrative Environmental Medicine. So that's environmental medicine that takes a little bit of a different perspective, right?
Right, exactly. Well, you know, the storyline for this text a few years ago is when I really kind of put the idea together and then joined, efforts with my colleague and co-editor, Dr. Fred Von Saal. Environmental medicine really is the idea that our environment has an effect on our health and that you can't really separate the two. When we do something with the environment positively or negatively, it will have a relationship to how we do as human beings or even animals and wildlife. And so really the storyline, in my opinion, and how this book came to fruition is we really need to tell the story of what's going on in our environment and then make the connections of how these environmental changes can in fact be playing out into chronic health diseases for human beings and for wildlife. And that's really how this all began. And then what do we do about it instead of just really telling everyone everything's a mess, we're all going to be in trouble. What do we do about it? What are the proactive steps that human beings can really take for themselves, for their families, and in this case, with healthcare practitioners, what we could be telling our patients in terms of limiting those exposures.
And indeed, and the chapters are quite fascinating. There's the history and overview of environmental chemicals, which enumerates all the different things that have been introduced in our environment, sources and clinical aspects of environmental exposures, ranging from water pollution to contaminants in the indoor air, pesticides, disinfectants, heavy metals. You even have a chapter on microwave and radio frequency radiation, you know,
sure,
the EMFs, electromagnetic
modern
fields.
Modern technology. Sure. Modern technology and what we're, you know, when we think about environmental exposures, you know, typically most people would think of air and water and perhaps food and food additives, which there's a wonderful chapter on food additives and the history of them. But what we don't really think about are other types of environmental exposures, which I get into in my chapter. But we think about, you know, think about the technology that has changed over the last, you know, 50 to 100 years in terms of just the radio waves, microwaves, and how that may play into human health, fertility, even headaches and confusion and some other things that go along that are unseen, so to speak, or felt but not seen specifically. But then there's other environmental chemical or exposures such as synthetic light. Even medications are a type of environmental exposure. And there's a wonderful chapter in the book that was written by some really amazing research physicians at Mount Sinai. And that's on how low-dose pain medications like NSAIDs, like Advil, Motrin, Aleve, those types of drugs, and even Tylenol can even affect the chemistry of a fetus and how that can play into endocrine disruption and perhaps even changes in the male and female development. So there's quite a bunch of exposures that most people wouldn't think of, but we have to think about, you know, all of the things that affect human beings on a day-to-day basis and how we can actually be more conscientious and aware, and then so, you know, we can make those changes that are very practical.
There's something referred to in the book that is called the precautionary principle. What is that, and why should we pay attention to it?
That's actually a really wonderful way to step into these set of recommendations that I'll be making throughout this program. The precautionary principle was really set up in 1998 during a conference, and really what it says is that when an activity raises threat of harm to human health or the environment, precautionary measures should be taken even if some of the cause and effect relationships aren't actually established or fully established scientifically. So really we want to make decisions in our day-to-day lives that are based on the possibility of harm, even if there's no formal evidence, and if it seems reasonable to avoid that precaution.
So what's wrong with the way that we assess potential hazards in America? You know, we have an EPA, we have an FDA, and
not
they set
long.
Standards. Well, that's another story entirely.
That's a political issue.
Yeah.
But yeah, we have oversight bodies, and, you know, the way, you know, the government has been, or I should say certain arms of the government, such as the EPA and various monitoring groups have been working, which is wonderful, is that they, you know, they really oversee certain levels of certain contaminants in our environment as a whole. So there's, you know, they're very reasonable, I would say, recommendations, but that's just on what they've been testing. So in other words, the things that are not being tested, the thousands of chemicals that may not be tested, which is really the case because there's just too many chemicals. We have over 87,000 chemicals that are available now on the commercial market. And, you know, they've been grandfathered in even since 1976 with the, you know, with TSCA and the first Toxic Substance Control Act. So we now have thousands of chemicals that are actually put out onto the market in products that are byproducts as well as manufacturing of plastics and incinerators, different products, but also the way we combust and break down these products. And really, they've never been tested for safety, particularly in vulnerable populations, such as infants, the fetus, pregnant women, and also the elderly and immunocompromised patients. So unfortunately, we don't put out chemicals. We're not legislatively mandated in this country to put out chemicals that have been tested first. They go to market, and then we wait to see, I guess, if something happens. And many of the things that I talk about are under the wire. You know, they're really low-level exposures over time that add up to chronic illness as opposed to sort of a toxic spill.
And then there's a sort of a new math that applies to these thousands and thousands of chemicals, which is 1 + 1 = 5. How does that happen? There's, you know, you would think, well, you know.
Oh, You're talking about the synergy.
The synergy between these things.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that's really important to note is that when medications are tested, for instance, medications are also chemicals, they're tested for what they were set out and designed for. We don't always see what the downstream issues are or other health-related issues that can come from one particular medication. The same goes for environmental chemicals. We may know a little bit about a class of chemicals, such as phthalates or parabens or sulfates, but we don't necessarily know, number one, if they have other effects other than what they're being tested for, if they are tested, and we also don't know how they synergize with all the other hundreds of chemicals that we may be involved with or exposed to. One chapter, as I mentioned, was a medical, was a chapter written by two wonderful researchers, and they found that medicines that we take very commonly, when they synergize even with environmental chemicals that are actually in our bloodstream, they synergize to have more endocrine effects than they would if any of those chemicals or medications were tested alone. So, yes, there is a question of synergy that we really haven't been able to get a full handle on in terms of repercussions.
Well, let's do a little bit of a lightning round about some of the potential hazards before we get to solutions. Identifying hazards, I think, is the first step. And we talk about endocrine effects. So there are these endocrine disruptors, sometimes referred to as gender benders. What's up with that?
So endocrine disrupting chemicals, or EDCs as they're called, are really a group of chemicals. And, you know, chemicals can be divided out in many ways. It can be divided out into organs that they cause harm to, such as neurotoxins or carcinogens. They can be divided out into the purpose of the chemical's design, so pesticides or solvents. Or plasticizers, something they're designed for. When it comes to endocrine disrupting chemicals, those are a group of chemicals were found to disrupt the human endocrine system, or in animal studies, the endocrine systems of animals, in test subjects. So, you know, what the endocrine system in the human body is so very intricate. It has so many unbelievably intricate physiologic components to it. So, for instance, the endocrine system helps with growth and development, as we know. It helps with fertility. Bone growth, specifically even in osteoporosis, we know that's an endocrine-related system and function. We know that it manages metabolism. Breastfeeding, fertility, intelligence, and behavior is managed under the endocrine system, particularly with certain nutrients like iodine. So there's quite a bunch of things, you know, particularly hormones, which work at such minute levels, parts per million, parts per trillion. And many of these chemicals, these endocrine disruptors, can mimic hormones and cause some of the same activities that we may not even want to go on. So again, it's almost like they're mimicking our own body's very, very, very specific messaging system, and that's very, very dangerous. Not only for adults, but particularly for a growing fetus, when they have to have the right processes laid down and systems coordinated when they're growing as a fetus.
And these are ubiquitous. They're in cosmetics. They're in the linings of cans. They're even in some plastic bottles. Many plastics have what are called xenoestrogens, which are estrogen-mimicking compounds.
So you're absolutely right on that. Endocrine disruptors are really pervasive. But when I talk to groups and communities, and when I have the Smart Human is my my platform for educational information on Facebook and Twitter, Instagram, the Smart Human. When I post, I'm posting information in regards to sort of activities that we do every day, something that you can relate to as an average American person or any human being on the planet, any person that wants to make simple changes. And really, the idea is, we are exposed to many of these chemicals, endocrine disrupting chemicals included. How do we take those out of our life, or at least lower exposure during activities that we do every day? So as you mentioned, canned goods, for instance. Canned goods pretty ubiquitously have what's called bisphenol A or BPA, which is a plastic coating that lines the inside of cans. And when we eat foods from cans, which we can't always control, of course, cafeterias and, you know, when we eat out, those kind of things, we don't really know ultimately the source. But when we have canned food, particularly foods that are more acidic, like tomatoes, for instance, we absorb a little, the food absorbs some of that BPA into the food itself. So we're absorbing some of that food packaging with every exposure to that, to canned foods, and that includes sodas as well. Now, BPA, for instance, has a very short half-life, meaning it has about a six-hour time limit of when the body will break it down and eliminate it. But many of the problems that are going on now is that despite having a short half-life for some of these chemicals, we're exposed all the time. So we end up maintaining a relatively high level of in our blood because we're really just getting exposed all the time. It never actually goes away unless you change the behavior and avoid canned or packaged foods. And in fact, there are wonderful studies showing that you can actually lower the urinary BPA breakdown products, meaning that you can make a difference actually on that particular chemical if you work, you know, to do that.
What about pesticides and herbicides? You know, some of the most notorious ones like DDT have been taken off the market, but others that are thought to be innocuous may actually have adverse effects.
Yeah, that's really, and pesticides are really pervasive in this country, no doubt. And some of the, you know, higher volume pesticides such as glyphosate or Roundup, which we now know has been growing dramatically over the past 20 or so years. Glyphosate and some of these pesticides, that's an herbicide, Roundup. You know, they're sprayed on actually genetically modified crops, which are used for, you know, like soy and corn is genetically modified in this country. 94% of all soy and corn in this country, uses glyphosate because it's genetically modified and they're tied together to the seed. You know, because they are pervasive, we have to think about, you know, how can we as an individual for ourselves or our families, you know, try to lower that pesticide load, which, you know, pesticides are linked to a whole host of health-related issues, particularly as in the book, there's a chapter on pesticides and neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's and ALS. The way we can, you know, limit exposure is a couple of ways, actually. Number one, we can buy organic produce and organic foods because many of the harmful pesticides that are used in the production of conventional fruits and vegetables are eliminated when you're using organic produce. And so that's very helpful. If there's no access to organic produce or cost is too high, then there's other ways to reduce residue, which is basically washing fruits and vegetables and other produce in vinegar, one part vinegar to three parts or four parts of clean water, and soaking that and seeing how much of the residue can come off. And then there's also great resources that I, you know, post on social media, like Environmental Working Group. And
right, they have the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. So every year, EWG, which is a wonderful nonprofit, terrific resource, they actually do testing on conventional fruits and vegetables across the country. And every year they come up with a new list, which is their Dirty Dozen, which is their top 12 produce that have the highest levels of residues when tested versus the Clean 15, which are the 15 top conventional produce that was tested and has the lowest amount of residues. So really it gives people options that if they're not going to buy organic for whatever the reason may be, they can certainly have other choices based on this yearly testing that goes on with EWG. And that's available online. It's downloadable and very easy to access.
I saw some nice-looking strawberries in the market the other day. They look suspiciously fresh, considering that the temperatures are freezing here in the Northeast.
Right.
But they top the list of the Dirty Dozen, actually.
Yeah. Strawberries are number one. Spinach surprisingly moved to number two this year.
Oh, wow.
Which is interesting because I live in New Jersey, and you know, it's one of the top three states that produce spinach in this country. So it's like California, New Jersey, and I'm not sure what the third is. So, you know, as a person who lives here, I'm very conscious we're the Garden State, and so I take a keen eye to the EWG list.
On the other hand, your pretty safe bet for you is avocados, onions, eggplant on the list of the clean 15, because they don't require a lot of pesticides to grow them.
Yeah, I think, with the Clean 15, this year's, I think that was the 16, 2016 was in the textbook. They just came out with 17 just this past week. And sweet corn, avocado, pineapple, cabbage made the top four out of that Clean 15. And, it's not clear what changes from year to year and why, you know, some things move up and some moves down. But, you know, really the general rule is, any produce that has a skin that you're going to eat, you don't want to cut away the skin because the skin actually has a remarkable number of nutrients. But what you want to do is try to find out how it was made, and if you can avoid just the top, maybe even five on the Dirty Dozen, and try to get organic versions, that may be better. The skins, you know, they're very absorbent. So when you're talking about berries, for instance, or pears or peaches, you know, you're talking about a skin that's going to be something you're eating as opposed to something, you know, like a pineapple or an avocado where you can at least take off the outer layer.
On the other hand, it doesn't make a lot of sense to pay double for organic avocados, as I see so often, or organic grapefruit, because maybe the difference won't be so great.
Right,
if you're on a budget.
And I think these are the exactly. And I think my whole premise of what I try to do and teach is you really have to work with what's right for you and your family, and really, you know, partition out your resources, you know, in a way that makes sense. And work from high yield to low yield. There's plenty of great changes that we can even go into in terms of just environmental changes that really don't cost any money. They're just really more about being smart and making those changes because they're easy and you're now armed with knowledge.
Okay, hold that thought, because we divide our podcast into two parts, as our listeners know. And when we return with today's guest, Dr. Ailey Cohen, she's co-author or co-editor of a wonderful compendium of articles on environmental medicine. The book is entitled Integrative Environmental Medicine. It's part of the Wild Integrative Medicine Library. And I recommend it very highly if you are one of the many integrative health practitioners or health practitioners in general who listen to this podcast. And I know there are many of you out there. This is an essential part of your library. If you are a very enlightened layperson and want to get really into do a deep dive on environmental medicine, this book is also a great resource for you and your family. When we return, some practical solutions from today's guest, Dr. Ailey Cohen. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.